councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
It is a big idea. A new world order.
It was almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
But I also believe that a lot of gun owners would agree that AK-47s belong in the hands of soldiers, not in the hands of criminals.
Guns will be taken. No one will be able to be armed. We're going to take all the guns.
For many of the police and guard troops, it is an uncomfortable job to do this in an American city.
Is global governance at last? Is it one world? The central bankers in charge. But aren't we all just living and dying for what the central banks do?
As for me, give me liberty or give me death!
The answer to 1984 is 1776.
Welcome to the InfoWars Nightly News. I'm David Knight. It's April 19th, 2013. 20 years to the day after the government burned the people at the Waco compound just north of where we are here in Austin. And we've got an interview coming up at the end of the show that we taped earlier with Mike McNulty. He's a documentary film producer who followed that story for over 10 years to put together evidence as it unfolded. But we can see the same sorts of things happening today in this story that's happening with the Boston Marathon. You see elements of deception, of changing stories, of lies that have been uncovered. It took a very long time before we understood exactly what happened in Waco. And we're going to talk to Mike McNulty about that. But we see the same pattern developing here. We also see people, the way the media is manipulating this is exactly the same way that it happened 20 years ago. So stick around and take a look at this interview that we've got coming up, but we're going to cover some of the stories right now. Alex was on earlier and telling us about some breaking news. As it appears right now, one of the suspects is surrounded by the police in Boston, and we're getting some police transmitters that we're following live that say things like burn him out, but that's still developing, and so that's why we're going live, just in case something like that happens. But right now, at this very moment, we have a lockdown in Boston, essentially martial law. Was it declared? No. They did not declare martial law. We don't have wars declared in this country anymore, and they don't declare martial law when they have it either. What they do is they call it a lockdown. You know, kind of like what happens in schools when something bad happens in schools. And as we see, schools condition children to accept certain things and certain conditions and certain treatment and behavior. And the American public is being conditioned to accept gradually a police state. And we're seeing this unfold in an unprecedented amount of coverage for one 19-year-old individual. Now, certainly it was a heinous crime, but the amount of people and the militarization of the police is just astonishing. As we had a caller call into the radio show earlier, he was saying, we have some photographs of that, some video. They're actually taking people out of their homes and relocating them to other places as they go through their homes and inspect those homes. Just amazing. And where is the Fourth Amendment in all of this? We've seen this type of pattern before. Our founders of our country saw this type of pattern. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment. That's why we have guarantees of due process that everyone who accepts a position with the government, whether it is a position of law enforcement or whether it's a political position, they all swear allegiance to the Constitution. They are swearing not to do the very things that you're seeing done right now in this video. There's no taxis being allowed. Everyone is shut down. There's pictures elsewhere. You'll see the streets of Boston look like a ghost town because they're looking for one person. Now, we've been covering the pictures that they've had press conferences with the FBI. They've had press conferences with Janet Napolitano, and they tell you, don't look at those pictures. Take all of your information from us. And they don't want you to see the different pictures that are out on the Internet. There's a picture of one of the suspects from earlier tonight, actually this morning. We had a picture of someone who looked like he was under arrest, but then the names changed. We were told that they were arrested, then we were told that they were killed. So at this moment, there's a lot of confusion as to what's coming out, but we're getting very rapidly modifying and changing stories. And one of the things that we're trying to track down is we're looking at there's a fellow right there in a khaki pants uniform and dark jerseys. This is the type of uniform, as Alex pointed out, and as we showed you at the Kraft website, thecraft.com, that's Kraft International, that's the security consultant firm that was formed by Chris Kyle, who was just recently died, and former Navy SEALs. As someone called earlier and told us, they don't typically provide security service. What they typically do is provide security training. And so that also brings up the question of, was there a drill going on there? As we know, in London, in the 7/7 bombings, there was actually a security analyst who went live on television, and you can see that on YouTube, saying, well, we were hired as consultants to do a training analysis and a session, and it was going on at exactly the same time, exactly the same place. There you see the Navy SEAL insignia that we've seen, and that's at the Kraft, and those are, we saw those pictures on the caps of some of the people that were there at the site. And if you go to the Kraft, you'll see uniforms that look very much like the pictures that we've put on InfoWars. But as we were told on 7/7, the guy actually went live on television and said he was astonished that it was happening at the same time as the actual bombing raid, that the scenario was exactly identical, the timing was identical, the place was identical. And that is a real hallmark for a false flag operation. And as Alex just pointed out, a false flag can be the government itself doing it, or they can be running provocateurs who do it. The point is that they have knowledge of it, they offer cover for it, and they use it to transform society. And we were told immediately after this happened that this was going to be a transformational event for America like September 11th. And if you look at what's going on in the city of Boston right now, it does look like America has been transformed into a police state for a manhunt of one 19-year-old individual. Now, if we look at this article that we have coming up here, National Guard weapons of mass destruction teams were on hand in Boston yesterday. There are pictures of individuals who have CST on their back. If we can go to that next picture there. Not those individuals there. Those individuals are the ones that we were showing you. But in this article and a subsequent article, there were actually pictures of civil support teams. And these are teams, that's the picture I'm talking about right there. Now, they don't have backpacks on. They have something strapped to their thigh. And on their back, they are clearly labeled CST teams. And those are teams that are looking for weapons of mass destruction. And we are told that they are routinely at large events. But what we saw was something that was a bit different. What we saw were people wearing similar clothing, except they had backpacks, and they had a hat that looked like the Navy SEAL-type Punisher type of logo. Also, there is the NukeSafe Portable Guardian backpack. If you could pull that up, we'll take a look at that. That is a backpack. Perhaps that was what some of these guys are wearing. It's a portable radiation detection system available as a backpack, and you can see there that it's got a kind of a remote control device down at the bottom. And there was that one picture of a fellow who is outfitted in the khaki pants and the black shirt, and he also had a backpack, and he had a device that looked like it may have been something similar to this. We don't know for sure. But as we look at the backpacks, one thing that comes to mind that I've thought about is the initial pictures that we were shown of the backpacks that the bombs came out of. They were black backpacks with distinctive gray striping on them. Now, when they fingered the two suspects that they're currently after, especially the younger one who is now at large, his backpack was actually a gray backpack. There's the device that we were talking about earlier. His backpack was actually a gray backpack. And when we're talking about the media losing its objectivity, losing its skepticism about what the government is telling us, and checking out what the government is telling us to be sure that it's true, we've gone exactly the opposite direction. CNN, after it was pointed out that one of the backpacks was gray and not even black, came up with what I like to call their Modrioski theory of backpack bombs. You know, the Modrioski is these little wooden Russian dolls that are split in half, and there's you know, you open it up and there's a smaller one inside, and then inside of that there's a smaller one inside of that, and so forth and so on. You can stack them up. They actually pulled up and they said, well, here's a, it could have been something like this. We could have had a light-colored backpack, and inside of that could have been a dark-colored backpack, and inside of that could have been a bomb. And it's like, why is CNN doing plausibility coverage for the police story? I mean, if it's a backpack that doesn't match the description, why don't they just leave it at that and say that an explanation is forthcoming? But instead, they actually go through and create a cover story, essentially, to try to make sense of something that doesn't really fit the descriptions. Now, along that line, we have a story at InfoWars that when we try to post the story that we have written about suspicious men wearing backpacks, and you see the picture there, it is being blocked by Facebook. Facebook is blocking it. We are told that the actual link has now been blocked. When we try to put it up, it says the content you are trying to share includes a link that has been blocked for being spammy or unsafe. Now, there's nothing spammy or unsafe about that unless unsafe includes something that doesn't fit the government's constructed narrative. Very suspicious that that Facebook is now blocking information about these individuals that we first pointed out. Now, the aunt of the bombing suspects is very skeptical as well. She says, show us the evidence. I'm suspicious that this was staged. She said, I am a lawyer, and there are four of us in the family. Her name is Merit Tsarnaev, if we're pronouncing the last name correctly. She lives in Toronto. She says, I can't lightly accept this kind of accusations without supporting evidence. Forgive me, but I cannot. Could it be staged? I have to question everything. That's my nature. That should be the nature of reporters. Reporters should be questioning this instead of trying to explain away anything that sounds fishy or implausible in the government's official story. But instead, time and time again, we see that these possible perpetrators wind up being shot. So there is never a trial. There is never any discovery of the evidence. But let's go to that clip right now. We have the aunt talking about this earlier.
For me to be convinced that these two nephews of mine committed these kind of atrocities cannot be taken lightly. And I found it strange. Tamerlan is walking in the front. Jahar is in the back. Why wouldn't they come together? Just, you know, together as brothers, as I used to know them.
So then are you suspicious that maybe they really did do this?
No, I'm suspicious that this was staged. The picture was staged.
By who?
Whoever needs this,
but why would
whoever is looking for those who need to be blamed for these attacks.
So you think they're being set up by someone else, not the authorities. You think they're being set up by someone else?
What do you mean, somebody else?
Well, who is setting
up? Who is interested in this case? When you're blowing up people and you want to bring attention to something for some purpose, you know, you do that mass.
Very good point. What is the motive of this? Why haven't they claimed responsibility for this? Why would Chechens do this? We're not told. Any more than why would some right-wing terrorist, as the Southern Poverty Law Center would say, why would they do something like that? There's not really any motivation for why they would do it. We know that the government has a motivation for having something like this happen. We know that they've been equipping for a police state. They've been changing the fundamental laws of this country. They've been incrementally moving towards this date and this technique for a long time. Let's take another look at the mother has a press conference also, I believe.
No, my son would never do this. My son, it is a set up. He was controlled by FBI like for three, five years. They knew what my son was doing. They knew what actions and what the sites on internet he was going. They used to come home. They used to come, and talk to me. They used to tell me that, you know, that they are controlling his, they were telling me that he's a really a serious leader, and they are afraid of him. They said, they told me that whatever is he is, whatever computer site or whatever is there, whatever information he's getting, they are controlling him. So how could this happen?
So there's a lot of unanswered questions, and it's going to bear some investigation to take a look at this. But don't expect that CNN or Fox News or CBS or NBC or MSNBC are really going to investigate this. They're going to give you the official government line. The investigations are going to come from the alternative news sites like InfoWars. It's going to come from documentarians like Mike McNulty. That's where we're going to find out the truth. But we can see the pattern of behavior, just as we saw with Waco 20 years ago. And unfortunately, as I mentioned when we had the interview, when this happened 20 years ago, I was seeing people who were very, very unsympathetic, absolutely no compassion for the Branch Davidians, who did not care that they were not given any reasonable due process. And now we see some of those same groups. We see evangelical Christians now being attacked and listed as enemies by Lieutenant Colonel Frank Rich, I believe is his name, listing the American Family Association, the Family Research Council, as being hate groups, putting them in the same category as terrorist groups. And if you don't stand up for other people's rights because you don't like those people, because like this lady that we just heard, they have a strange foreign accent, if you will not stand for due process for others, you will not get it yourself. And we're seeing that coming home now. Now, speaking of due process and constitutional rights, one of the things that's been happening this week as we've all been watching this bombing, CISPA is being run through. That's the House Cybersecurity Bill. That's gone through, sailed through very easily through the Republican-controlled House. It is now going to the Democrat Senate, where there is more resistance to it. Obama has promised to veto it, but can we really trust him? After all, he promised to veto the NDAA. He said he would not sign it. But then he said, I'll sign it, but I won't actually do anything with it. Well, we'll see what happens with that. But I've got to say that we need to stand up. You know, it seems like when the Republican politicians hear the word security, they reflexively lift their arm like Dr. Strangelove in the wheelchair and salute and say, Sieg Heil. You know, anytime... Yes, he promised... Marcos is correcting me. He promised not to sign the NDAA. But he is now saying that he doesn't want to, that he might veto the CISPA Act, but we don't know that he's going to do that. What I'm saying is that we need to make sure that Republicans will contact the Republican legislators and tell them that the Fourth Amendment is just as important to them as the Second Amendment is. And I want to take a look at some of the things that are going on behind the scenes with CISPA. You know, it came up as the SOPA Act last year, and that was defeated, and that was basically focusing on copyright issues and things like that. Now that it's presented as a security issue, Republicans are all for it. And we have an article here that says, is this going to be the death of the Fourth Amendment? And what they're saying is, it means that this is an interesting way that this is going to go through. They basically give immunity to corporations to release your private information to the government without having any Fourth Amendment protections. And in the article it says, this means that a company like Facebook, Twitter, or Google, or any other technology or telecom company, including your cell service provider, would be legally able to hand over vast amounts of data to the U.S. government and its law enforcement for whatever purpose it deems necessary and face no legal reprisals. There are no requirements that personal data, such as health records or banking information, should be anonymized either before sharing it with the government. So essentially what it does is it removes the legal liability for private corporations to share private information about you to the government. And the government can say, well, we didn't need to get a Fourth Amendment court order, because we're not taking it directly. It's being handed over to us by a third party. Do you see how deceptive that is? And it says here also in the article, the Fourth Amendment does not protect private companies from accessing and data mining your information for its own gain. It only protects against the U.S. government unlawfully accessing your information without a search warrant. Now, another aspect of this that bears looking at is... The article, it says CISPA supporters spend 140 times as much money lobbying as opponents. Now, when SOPA came through, corporations put down a lot of money to fight that. But now, very little money is being put down to fight it, and there are a lot of corporations, big defense contractors, military industrial complex corporations that are pushing in favor of this. Now, why do they like this? Well, they stand to benefit from big defense contracts. We have to understand that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about has not only got us involved in perpetual war for the last 60 years, but that military-industrial complex is now hungry for even more money. They're not satisfied with multiple wars on foreign soil. They want to fund a giant police state here domestically. There's a lot of money to be made out of that. And one of the people that's going to make a lot of money out of that is the wife of the Republican legislator who is pushing for this. Mike Rogers, the biggest sponsor and spokesperson in favor of CISPA, his wife, Christy Clemens Rogers, she is the CEO of Aegis LLC. That's A-E-G-I-S LLC. She just got a $10 billion, that's B, billion-dollar security contract with the U.S. State Department for security services. And she writes articles about cybersecurity. Now, Rogers has said some pretty amazing things in defense of this bill. He's made claims that there's no companies that oppose it, that only 14-year-olds who are blogging and tweeting from their basement support it. He's said that this is not about getting any private information on anybody. It's simply all a bunch of ones and zeros. Can you believe that he said something that incredibly stupid? All digital communication is ones and zeros, but there's a lot of content. All of your personal information is transmitted as ones and zeros. Certainly, he's got to realize that we know that. And lawmakers have cited the Boston bombing and WikiLeaks as justifications for passing CISPA. You see, if they call it security, they can get you scared about anything and expect that you're going to surrender your rights. And certainly we don't want to know the types of things that have come out of WikiLeaks, the types of things that have been secrets that have been revealed about Henry Kissinger and that sort of thing. This bears watching, and again, I repeat, this is not passed yet. It faces more opposition in the Senate. The Democrats, for some reason, are a little bit more friendly to civil liberties than Republicans are, especially if security is mentioned. So we have a chance to defeat this in the Senate, especially if we put pressure on Republican lawmakers who typically would reflexively vote on that. And we have to understand that it is an uphill battle because there are a lot of big corporations who are pouring a lot of money into this and stand to gain very big military contracts, as well as a lot of businesses. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is supporting this because they see this as a way of essentially not getting stuck in a tug of war between law enforcement and civil lawsuits of people that they are turning their information in. Now, one last story we have tonight, and then we're going to go to the interview that we have with Mike McNulty. Before the blast, West Fertilizer's Monsanto lawsuit, there was a lawsuit going on, a class action lawsuit that's been going on for a couple of years between the fertilizer company that just had the massive explosion up in Waco. That was going on with Monsanto, and that's been dragging on and on. So that's a story that has a lot of interesting elements to it. We're not saying necessarily this is a conspiracy to set up to draw attention away from the anniversary of the Waco bombing, but it is amazing that that happened so close to the anniversary of Waco, that it happened so close to there being a emergency drill there that was one day away, and that it involved fertilizer, albeit on a much, much larger scale than Oklahoma City. If you remember the Oklahoma City bombing that also happened on April the 19th, retired military generals came forth, at least one, came forth and said that that it was not plausible that a fertilizer bomb would either do that much damage or have that kind of blast pattern by itself. So I don't know. This is a giant explosion, but it was a tremendous amount of fertilizer explosive there. We're going to go to a break. We've got a report coming up from Jakari Jackson. And we just got a news release that they captured him live. Is that correct? Okay. Well, it looks like they have just... Oh, okay, they're calling for a medic, so he may not survive to have trial and discovery. Certainly hope that he does. We don't know at this point. You know, we're always very careful to say that someone is an alleged suspect. And hopefully the police would have that kind of deference to not shoot someone until they've been, until they've had their due process and been found guilty, that they would not enact street justice on them. We would very much like to know his side of the story. And so we very much hope that he survives. We would like to hear that story. But one way or the other, we're going to have tireless people like Mike McNulty, who spent, as I said, over 10 years and documented how people like Eric Holder, who was very much involved in the Waco trial as well as in the Oklahoma City bombing, he documents very closely what happens with the process, and he did a lot of Freedom of Information data and very detailed tests about the fires that happened at Waco. So stay tuned for that right after the break.
The important thing about the Pro One filter today is that the material we use for removing fluoride and other heavy metals now will remove the latest form of fluoride called hydrofluorosilicic acid. There's no other fluoride reduction filter out there that will remove that type of fluoride. And it's extremely important because today we're hearing more and more cities are using that form of fluoride.
We've been having medication forced on us through the water system for quite a while. Most people don't realize it. Most people don't realize the negative effects of fluoride.
There's a wide range of health effects that are attributed to fluoride.
Bottom line, why should somebody get this new Pro One ProPure filter?
The reason to buy the Pro One, it's an all-in-one filter. It's convenient, easy to use. It doesn't require the add-on fluoride filter. And in addition, this filter removes the latest form of fluoride called hydrofluorosilicic acid.
I'm Darren McBreen, and these are some of the new items that are available now at InfoWarsShop.com.
Alert the public to Obama's blatant abuse of power with the new Obama t-shirt. Obama's Joker face on the front and come and take it on the back. It's time to publicly call him out for what he is, a tyrant. Defend the Second Amendment with our top seller come and take it t-shirts. And look at that, women's cut tank tops and t-shirts now available. Nice hat. Plus the Don't Tread on Me flag. And now you can become a micro distributor of the InfoWars magazine. Plus get your own copy delivered right to your door each and every month. And if you're tired like I am of you and your family being exposed to polluted drinking water, get the Pro One High Performance Water Filter. It gets rid of all pathogenic bacteria, cysts, fluoride, heavy metals, and numerous other contaminants.
So join the revolution at InfoWarsShop.com.
Well, today is April the 19th. It's a very significant day in tyranny. It was the day that the British moved against those that conquered in Lexington to take not only their muskets but cannons. It's also the day that the Nazi Panzer Division got tired of fighting the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto and burned them out completely. And it's the day that the U.S. government got tired of the Waco siege, and many of us believe burned those people there to death. And we need to take a look at that and understand the implications that it has for us today. And some people do. Let's look at this clip earlier from someone who was looking at Obama's gun control legislation, a mayor in New York.
Most people are law-abiding citizens and may go ahead and sell those or turn those over, but you're going to have a faction of people that are going to take a stand. And I can just predict a Waco-style standoff in some rural area, and it's not going to end well.
Now, when Caesar crossed the Rubicon with his army, that was the point at which people realized Rome had become a dictatorship. And so that's become something of a metaphor. And, you know, the crossing of the Rubicon for the American government, in my opinion, for me personally, happened before September 11th. Now, September 11th was used to create a legal framework and to change many fundamental things legally in our country. But to me, the Rubicon was crossed from a republic into a military dictatorship when the Branch Davidian compound was burned down. And that whole siege for me was a really kind of an awakening. And I guess perhaps it was because the age that I was at that time. But we have someone with us today who has shed a great deal of light on that. He's essentially worked on that for the last 20 years. He's investigated this. He's uncovered freedom of information requests and put together a large story, a detailed story about exactly what has happened there. His name is Mike McNulty, and he's a film producer, and we're going to talk to him about his films on the Waco disaster. Well, Mr. McNulty, it is wonderful to talk to you. I can't tell you how much your documentaries have meant to me. And as I said before, this is the point for me at which I realized that America had crossed the Rubicon.
Well, thank you, David. I'm happy to be here with you today.
I'd seen the very first movie that you did. We had video stores at the time, and we did everything we could to get people to watch this. At the time this all happened, I was an activist with the Libertarian Party, and there wasn't anything like the Internet. But we were passing around information as it was unfolding in real time, and we were watching, just as we are this week, we were watching the difference between what the mainstream media and the government was telling people and what we were getting from eyewitness reports. And for us, we had this experience 20 years ago, and we were looking at this and saying, this doesn't add up. They just lied about this. They just contradicted what they just said. We saw them demonizing David Koresh, saying that they were coming in to protect the women and the children, to protect the children, and then they wind up burning the children up in this thing. It was just amazing for us. We didn't have the facts that surfaced later in your documentary, because you did a lot of research and freedom of information requests and that sort of thing, and unfolded this over a number of years. Tell us about the progress of that. You've done three documentaries on Waco.
Our friends at the FBI and the Justice Department claim that I was an underhanded dirty dealer. And the truth was, I used something that for them was sort of a dirty trick, because nobody had ever bothered to use this tool in the past. They operate on a one-week news cycle. The events at Waco lasted 51 days, and so I got on the project at the conclusion of events and worked on it from there. But the secret tool that I used was a little thing called time. Instead of rushing right out so I could beat the competition to the next deadline, I simply took almost 3 years to make the first film, and about half that much, about 18 months to make the second, and another year to make the third. And the process was invaluable, because I had the opportunity to make the acquaintances of, time had passed, perceptions had changed, and feelings about what had happened had changed. And so it allowed me to, for example, become acquainted with a gentleman by the name of Bill Johnson, who was the assistant U.S. attorney who planned the original Waco raid on February 28th and led it. And he was, by the time I got to him, beginning to have some real pangs of conscience about what happened. And in the meantime, the court system had had its way with the Branch Davidians, completed the cycle. And so I suggested to Bill, after we got to know each other a little bit, sure would be nice if I could go into the evidence locker that you guys hold there at the Texas Ranger headquarters and sort of look around at the evidence. Think I could do that? He said, well, everything's done. Sure, why not? So we went on a little visit. One of the earlier submissions on my blog site covers that, shows pictures of the results, and talks about the things we found in there, including the so-called missing front door. There's a lot of misinformation that we had to wade through, starting with the famous flamethrower tank video that was just completely bogus. But that led to other information that we found that led us to other things that helped develop what we now know as Waco, the Rules of Engagement, Waco, a New Revelation, and the FLIR Project.
You know, it's interesting because, as you said, as this was unfolding, we were seeing the same kind of misinformation from the government and the press, backpedaling, changing the story, demonizing people. And to put it this in context, We have to understand that just a few months prior to this, before the Clinton administration took office, this was at the very beginning of the Clinton administration. This all began in March after he was sworn in January. But it was back, I think it was after the election, wasn't it, that Ruby Ridge had happened. And of course, it was all the same players, the same actors involved. This, again, is not a Democrat-Republican thing. This isn't necessarily a Clinton thing. It's kind of a bureaucracy thing. Now, the people that were at the top, Janet Reno and the others, they absolutely have criminal culpability and the lies and the decisions that they made. But this is something that was pervasive throughout the bureaucracy, wasn't it?
Well, I'm working on a new project that the working title is The American Gestapo. And it focuses on agencies within the federal bureaucracy. And I won't name them all right now, but there's some.
We don't have the time, right?
Well, it's a long list.
There's so many.
The fact of the matter is that, presidents change and directors of agencies change. And sometimes they don't from one administration to another. For example, Mr. Mueller, the director of the FBI, he's been around for Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that's where the real nitty-gritty happens. Now, you pointed or alluded to the contravention of statements made to the press versus actions taken on the ground. One of the problems with the Waco business from an administrative point of view relative to law enforcement is the nature of the relationship between negotiators and negotiating staff and the, in this case, the hostage rescue team or the tactical or SWAT team people.
Mm-hmm.
If you get into an elongated situation, you're going to find conflict develop rapidly between negotiators and the people on the ground trying to enforce the rules. Now, this is not in their defense. This is to understand how the system works. So the longer you go in a standoff situation, for example, the more exertion that the hostage rescue team or SWAT people are going to put onto the subject of getting you out of wherever you are,
mm-hmm.
versus what the negotiators are trying to do, which is a compassionate resolution where nobody gets killed.
But as we were saying, as we were speaking just before the interview started, and talking about this idea of Caesar crossing the Rubicon and the U.S. becoming some kind of a police state dictatorship, you were saying that, in your opinion, this is, we think of dictatorships as being one man like Julius Caesar or Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin, and yet what we're seeing here in this country, and perhaps that's what you're going to be covering in your next documentary, is that it really is a systemic thing that transcends necessarily one individual person, and it's systemic throughout the bureaucracy, isn't it?
Yeah, well, a lot of people like Ronald Reagan. And he tried to go in and change the system. And he came back to report to the American people, you can't change it. It winds up changing you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You have to remember that the first president of the United States that violated posse comitatus was Herbert Hoover with the bonus marchers in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And which nine World War I veterans were killed, and they were run out of their encampment trying to get their bonuses from Congress by none other than General MacArthur and two majors that worked for him. One's name was Dwight David Eisenhower, and the other one's name was George S. Patton.
Mm-hmm.
And they used tanks and cavalry and ground troops to run these people out at the point of bayonets and rifles.
Right.
And there's a reference to that on the blog site. And, then along came another president who had this riot going on, down in Talladega, Florida, involving the Muriel boat people back in the 80s. And, the prison guards couldn't get things under control. They brought the hostage rescue team in and, from the FBI, and interestingly enough, the man in charge of explosives and breaching at that incident in Talladega the Talladega prison, was the same man who was in charge of explosives and breaching at Waco, which if you look at the blog site and the film, you'll see were used.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your, I don't want to run out of time here before we talk about your documentaries. Let's get an overview of your documentaries, because you've done so much detailed research here, and it even overflows a series of three documentaries. You've got a huge amount of information on your website, which is copsproductions.com. That's copsproductions.com. And you go down through there, and it's essentially kind of like a, the sort of supplemental material you might find on a DVD, but it's additional research, text, pictures, videos that you've got there, six different postings at least at this time of that, right?
They're fairly lengthy.
Yes. Now, and you started originally, as we said, your first movie was Waco Rules of Engagement. Then you followed up on that subsequently in a few years with Waco, A New Revelation, and then you did the FLIR project after that. And the DVD that we're now starting to sell here at Infowars.com has those last two with the most comprehensive research in there. And tell us a little bit about, one of the big issues is who lit the fire, just like we're hearing with the Chris Dorner thing. And here we are 20 years to the day that everyone was incinerated, men, women, and children. When I came to Austin, I stopped by there, and it was just such a seminal moment for me. I had to stop by and see the Waco, and we want to call it a compound because that's just been drilled into our brain from the incessant repetition on the media. But it was their home, and to see the graves of these people, all different ages, all different ethnicities, and so many children there, and we have heard nothing but the repetition of the tragedy in Newtown, and this is far more extensive than the tragedy in Newtown in terms of the number of victims and the way that it happened, and yet it's largely ignored. Nothing is going to be said about that, I'm sure, today.
As President Clinton said famously in the Rose Garden, there were 27 Davidian children killed there, but after all, they were Branch Davidians.
Yeah, right. Right. And they were effectively able to do that in public opinion, too. So many people I knew, even Christians that I knew, had such a hardened attitude towards us. They had just shut off their compassion towards these deaths because they didn't like David Koresh's theology. He had some messianic ideas about it. But that was no reason to support the execution of him and the children that were there. That was absolutely insane. And you start out your blog number six. You start that out talking about the parallels with the Mormons. What happened with the Mormons?
Indeed, at Hans Mill in 1837. One of my best lines was during the time I was doing a lot of television, was that in reference to the children and the overall events, I really thought they stopped burning men, women, and their children at the stake as social heretics back in the 7th century. Right. But I guess they haven't.
No, they didn't. They essentially burned them in the media, and I saw so many people, as I said, Christians, who were like, yeah, well, they were crazy anyway. And it's like, even if they were crazy, you don't burn people if they're crazy like that. I went to the Libertarian Party National Convention in 1993, just a few weeks after the Waco incident had ended and the fiery deaths of all these people. And as we were going through, it was held in Salt Lake City, and we took the Mormon tour. And they have all these dioramas and everything talking about their history and how they were persecuted. And I came out of there and I said, this is exactly what just happened at Waco. And the Mormons who were there, for the most part, said, what? What?
Yeah.
They were in such a bubble, they didn't even know what had happened with them. I said, you better wake up. Because it happened to your people, it happened to these people, and it can happen in America again at any time to anyone.
Well, if the truth be known, David, I am a Mormon, and I was fully aware of the bubble you referred to, and the whole thing about, I explained this at the beginning of blog number six, what brought me to want to do something more than just watch events pass, was a remembrance of that piece of history in 1837 when the Mormons were, a group of Mormons were trapped by the state militia in Missouri and, forced into a log grist mill and, had the doors barred on them, and the men dismounted and put their muskets through the chinks in the logs and fired into the interior until everybody inside was dead or wounded.
Yes.
You know, all that just because the lieutenant governor of the state, Lillian Boggs, issued a little thing called an extermination order that was not repealed until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Wow.
And the extermination order was very much just that. If you were a Mormon found in the confines of the state of Missouri, you would be summarily executed. And they did.
And I see that same attitude now. 20 years ago, it was that same attitude that I saw with evangelical Christians towards the Branch Davidians. And now here we are 20 years later, and guess who's in the crosshairs of the military and the intelligence agencies? It's evangelical Christians are considered to be part of right-wing extremists. And I said at the time, I said, if you don't stand up for these people, it's the famous saying that's become almost a cliche, going back to Nazi Germany, where the priest, I believe, said, you know, they came for this group and I did nothing. They came for the next group and did that. Then they came for me and there was no one left because they had taken everyone. I said, that's going to happen in this country. And here we are 20 years later, and you see the U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Rich says that the American Family Association, the Family Research Council, probably two of the most mainstream evangelical organizations out there, that these people do not share Army values and they are hate groups. And if they're hate groups, of course, you can act hatefully towards them. You can do anything towards them. That's just shy of declaring them as a terrorist because we don't have any clear definition of what a terrorist is, do we?
We talked about this at the beginning of the show. The issue is not, do we have a dictator? No, we have a dictatorial mindset institutionalized within the agencies like the FBI and the BATF. And the nature of the game here is, to stay in business as an institution, they always have to have an enemy. So now they've gone into the business of creating their own, and it'd be us.
That's right. That's right. And their willing allies in all of this is the media that is using themselves, letting themselves be used essentially as a propaganda institute. I was absolutely, to keep this in the current context, as we've watched this Boston Marathon bombing unfold this week, we were absolutely flabbergasted when they identified these two guys, not showing any pictures. They said they didn't when they were asked at the press conference. You have video of them. When did they put the bags down? Oh, we don't know. Maybe it was a couple of minutes before it went off. Do you have pictures of, well, we might have those later. And then as they released these pictures, Leanne McAdoo was the first one in our group to notice that, one of these guys had the wrong color backpack. And then CNN comes on later that night and says, well, this is how that could have worked out. I mean, they're created, and they essentially created what I call the Madrioski theory of the bombers, where you've got a backpack inside of a backpack and then a bomb inside of that, you know, and say, well, he could have had a gray backpack inside of the black backpack, and then he could have had a bomb inside of the gray backpack. It's just absolutely ridiculous to see the hoops that they will jump through in order to support the official government story. And we saw that with Waco 20 years ago. And we saw that unfolding. As I said, the internet was not in place yet. Few people were passing information around.
An FBI agent by the name of Robert Ricks that was conducting the daily Dog and Pony Show. And a good friend of mine, James Tate, from Soldier of Fortune magazine was there, having a great deal of fun just poking and prodding these guys and including Jeff Jamar, the FBI agent in charge, special agent in charge. And, They were constantly, if you watch the films that I've done, it's a constant theme throughout all the films that we've done that, okay, the government said they did this. They carefully removed the vehicles from outside of the building in order to make sure it was safe for the Branch Davidians to come out. Well, then we showed the videotape of a Bradley fighting vehicle. I didn't know they could travel quite that fast, going about 55, 60 miles an hour, hauling across the front of the building, and it drives right through a beautifully restored El Camino, a red El Camino pickup, and just crushes it. And, that's how they're carefully removing these people's property, right?
Yeah, right.
Of course, the Branch Davidians were watching this. They understood what the message was.
Yes. And it must be said, because it was said at the time, And these were the sorts of things that were in existence and being passed around that the media wasn't telling anybody at the time, that David Koresh had had issues with the law, but he had always been friendly. they had the local sheriff would come out and he would go in. They would have due process that we come to expect in America, where they have a trial and he's able to defend himself. And he had been found innocent of charges of child molestation and other disputes that had occurred with other members there. And yet, why wouldn't they follow that procedure? Why would they do a full-on raid with everybody there, with the media in place, and call out Showtime? It was pretty obvious that they were trying to do some public relations. It was a misguided public relations thing, I guess, in terms of trying to get back some respect and fear after what had happened in Ruby Ridge. It was such a train wreck.
Actually, David, it was a dog and pony show purely intended for the benefit of the United States Congress at the next hearings that were to take place later that summer, so as to retain within the confines of the BATF budget their so-called national SWAT teams, which were teams that were present at Waco on February 28th.
Still building their empire. And let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of the people involved here. You had mentioned to me just before we went on air about how the names don't change, do they? Talk about Eric Holder. What was Eric Holder's role in this? He's got a long history.
Well, the current attorney general was then a deputy attorney general to Janet Reno, his idol. How do I know it is his idol or she is his idol? Because there's only one picture that hangs in the attorney general's office today, and that's a painting of Janet Reno, and he proudly displayed that in an interview about a year ago.
That's pretty TV.
And so Mr. Holder's role in Waco, I have not been able to determine if he played a role in the actual events. My impression is that it was the whole system within the Justice Department was short-circuited. Janet Reno was left hung out to dry. Things were handled by Webster Hubbell, who was the Deputy Attorney General at that time, and they were controlled from the White House by Mrs. Clinton and Vincent Foster. So all of that has some detail in it in Waco, A New Revelation. But the point was, is that Mr. Holder was a needed shill, I should say, after events and after we released details from the upcoming newly released film, Waco, A New Revelation, and the press got it and ate it up, because one of the things we accused the FBI of doing was lying about the use of pyrotechnic devices at Mount Carmel on April the 19th. And so some members of the press got a hold of it and asked Miss Reno, about the use of these pyrotechnic devices that this filmmaker had discovered in the evidence locker in Austin. And boy, that set her off, and she went crazy. She sent the U.S. Marshals to the headquarters of the FBI hostage rescue team at Quantico, Virginia. And in their searching of the FBI's offices, which is a really strange thing, they discovered additional videotapes that they had claimed that they didn't have, which involved FLIR. And they also discovered photographs.
Let's put that, that's forward-looking infrared radar.
Forward-looking,
so
not radar.
It would show, sorry, yeah, what?
Not radar.
What is the R? What is the R there?
Infrared.
Infrared. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. And what that does, that shows a thermal footprint. So they can basically.
It's a thermal imaging system.
Yeah. Right.
And the fact was, is that they also discovered evidence of pyrotechnic devices that indeed had been used by the FBI. So Ms. Reno, had to recuse herself, because she had already testified before Congress that no pyrotechnics had been used. So she recused herself and appointed her deputy, her new kissy boy, Mr. Holder. Oh, that's a terrible thought. as the deputy attorney general in charge of the aftermath investigation,
I see.
Which is sort of like asking the wolf to guard the sheep pen after the sheep.
Oh, yeah. And he's been richly rewarded with that by the bureaucracy in subsequent years with his moving up the ladder.
So Mr. Holder was the man responsible for conducting the aftermath investigation and supervising the special counsel Mr. Danforth. Now, they'll tell you that Mr. Danforth simply reported results. He wasn't supervised, but I know better than that. The fact of the matter is Mr. Danforth did do a so-called recreation at Fort Hood, Texas. It was a sham. We found out about the sham and how they did it in detail, and we produced a little film called The FLIR Project, which is the second film included in this two-disc set commemorating the 20th anniversary of Waco. So you get a twofer on this one.
And before, we're nearly out of time. I want to give people an idea of the kind of detailed research that you do, because you've got a big picture of what's going on here, and you fill in the details, many of which took years to come out. And some of the details that are in here are technical details that are very interesting, just like you got the FLIR tapes. Tell us a little bit about what you found out about methylene chloride, and tell what methylene chloride is and what you found out about it.
Well, if your wife has ever nagged you, or maybe it was the husband nagging the wife, to refinish Aunt Bessie's old chest of drawers, the poor things were covered with 250 coats of old paint. The wife sent you down to the hardware store to get some paint stripper, chemical paint stripper, and it comes in a bottle that says methylene chloride. Well, methylene chloride has some very interesting properties. It's very toxic. You don't want to get too much of it on your skin at all. Mm-hmm. And the other problem with it is that when you put it on a set of desk of drawers, a chest of drawers, it certainly eats off the paint and everything, but it develops a horrendous amount of vapors, fumes, and it warns you right on the bottle, you know, do whatever you're doing with this stuff in a well-ventilated space.
Yes.
Well, why is that? Well, if you read the hazard data safety sheet provided by Monsanto, the makers of methylene chloride,
usual suspects.
Right there in bold print, it says vapors are highly flammable. Now, you might recall the testimony given by all the federal fire experts about the use of the methylene chloride as a solvent for the CS gas particulate. CS gas is not a gas, it's a powder. And it's microfine, 2 microns in size, these little particulate pieces. And in order to get it into the room, you gotta get it in there either by pyrotechnic means, where a stick that's been made of this stuff burns and the smoke carries the particulate into the atmosphere. The problem with that is that starts fires. And they didn't want to start fires, at least that was the story. Mm-hmm. So what they used was methylene chloride, mixing it in with the CS gas particulate, dissolving it as a solvent would, and so that they loaded it into little rockets, white rockets with a blue head. And they were 40 millimeter in diameter, and they'd fire them through M79 grenade launchers. That was one method of insertion. The other method of insertion, as shown in the film, was they put it into pressurized tanks, pressurized with carbon dioxide, and in a liquid form, methylene chloride with the CS suspended in the methylene chloride solution. When you spray that in the air, the particulate did an interesting thing. Methylene chloride does what it always does. It evaporates very quickly, and it leaves the CS particulate suspended in the atmosphere. Quite ingenious. The problem was that they didn't read the Monsanto hazardous data safety sheet about the vapors, or if they did, they ignored it. And when that happened, you're talking about dozens of gallons of this material poured into the building from 6 a.m. to 9, well, from 6 a.m. until noon, interesting things happen. Those vapors build up. There was a 30-mile-per-hour constant wind.
Yes, they waited till today. It was very windy, yes.
Extremely windy, the windiest day of the year, actually. Mm-hmm. And then we decided, wait a minute. Okay, so they pumped the building full of this very flammable material. The building itself was a fire trap looking for a place to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Branch Davidians had their own plan about starting a fire to keep the tanks out if they drove the tanks into the building, which the FBI promptly did during the course of the 6 hours of demolition on the building. And so between at least one Branch Davidian that we were aware of, starting a fire after the first fire started and the second fire started, by means of, well, let me go down the list. The first fire started in the upstairs bedroom at the southeast corner of the building at a little after noon. The tank inserting the CS methylene chloride mixture had just emptied a complete bottle into that room. At that particular point, according to the FBI 302 reports, several FBI observers close at hand to the building saw a Branch Davidian dressed in a black ninja suit, as they called it, come to the opening torn in the wall and fire at the tank. I believe he fired an AK-47 at the tank in frustration more than anything else. And when he did, within less than a minute, that room was engulfed in flames, and we saw the flames coming out that window. My contention is that that gentleman was the point of ignition of the first fire starting in that bedroom. It was an ignition of the methylene chloride and the CS gas particulate in the air column in that room that had just been pumped in by the tank. Mm. And he fired, and to prove this, we tested the methylene chloride. And at the website, the blog site, there's a section there that has video from those tests that we did. We didn't include it in the FLIR project because it wasn't relative to gunfire per se, the gunfire issue. It was more relative to the setting of the fire. And we were going to add it later, didn't have the money nor the time to do so. So I decided to put the material up on the blog site. But we take methylene chloride in spray bottles and spray it in the open in front of an M16 that's being fired about, I don't know, 3-4 feet in front of it in the air column. And when that gun goes off, you see the muzzle flash, but then you see the ignition of the methylene chloride in the open atmosphere on infrared. Mm. And it produces like a 30-foot-long huge flame.
Mm.
Now, well, that's burns very hot, and it burns much like alcohol does when it ignites. And in fact, in daylight, it's very hard to see the flames from the methylene chloride ignition.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just a sample for our audience of the kind of detailed information and research that you've done in your series of films. And if for no other reason, this is such an important and relevant event in our country's history, because to me it has the elements of a government where that kind of teeters back and forth between maliciousness and incompetence, and you're always kind of trying to guess where the needle is. Has it switched over into something that's absolutely totally premeditated and malicious, or are they just kind of Keystone Cop cowboys? What's the difference? And so it kind of seems like it teeters back and forth. But you did a lot of research. You did your own research, like you said, with this chemical, as well as Freedom of Information Act. You took a long time to put all this stuff together. And I guess from the time that it happened in 93 until the last documentary that you did, the FLIR project, that was 8 years. And now you put that together, and you're continuing to do research on your website. That is copsproductions.com. And I really appreciate and thank you for the work that you've done. And this is something that people need to look at, this because the way our government operates today and the way the media operates today has not changed. And that's why when we look at these issues and we see a lot of these hallmarks type of things coming, even though people criticize Alex Jones and InfoWars for jumping on this and calling BS when we see some of these things here, but we have seen this method of operation for a long time, and we know that they have a motivation to do these types of things from a bureaucratic standpoint and from forwarding their legislative agenda. Final remarks, Mr. McNulty?
One of the things that really motivated us to re-release the films at this time is Of course, as everyone knows, all of the insidious gun control issues that have been tried to be foisted onto the American people, either at the federal level or at the state level, like the state of New York and their alleged assault weapons ban. The beauty of that, in my mind, is that the people are resisting. Mm-hmm. They're saying, no, we're not going to do that. And it really has ticked off the powers that be, including Governor Cuomo. I think it's important for people to understand the necessity to resist, but also to be selective in how they do it and know what the counterpunch might be from the federal government. And the best example of that I can find relative to gun control issues, which was central to the Waco incident, is the Waco incident, how the government behaves, what their tactics are, right down to the military-style tactics that were employed. And to understand.
Yes, you can either wait for them to come pick up your guns, or you can fight back when they come to your house, or is there another alternative that you found?
In the blog site, I hope people read it. There is an alternative. I don't want anybody to go and turn in their guns. That's garbage. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't want them to have to face, at least not unwittingly, the wrath of the federal government, as did the Branch Davidians. What I suggest is that you have a stock of money on hand for attorney's fees. You hire an attorney. You make sure you know your county sheriff. You go down to the county sheriff when the time comes after you've secured your weapons, and you submit yourself to the federal authorities at the sheriff's office with lots of TV cameras and microphones and under the supervision of the sheriff and your attorney being present. They'll take you into custody. They'll lock you up, book you, all that good stuff. And, the truth is a judge may not like the idea that you've secured your guns as opposed to turn them over to the federal authorities, but I don't think I just turned them over. And then that means that he may deny you bail because you haven't given the guns over, so on and so forth. The point is you've done it through the legal system. It will tick off the ATF folks big time because they didn't get to go play their SWAT team games. And you'll fit your family and yourself will generally be safe under those circumstances. But you will have the cost of resistance is going to be the cost of the attorney fees and court and all the things that can happen if you're found guilty by a group of citizens who aren't informed of what the real Second Amendment is.
Yes, and that's why it's very important for us to get fully informed juries back, because that's at the point where the rubber meets the road. They have to at some point try to enforce these unconstitutional, or at the very least, these unreasonable laws. And if your fellow citizens will not stand for the unreasonableness of whether it's alcohol prohibition or whether it's sending somebody to jail for decades because of marijuana possession, or it's sending somebody to jail for life because they've got certain firearms in their possession, if your fellow citizens know that it is their duty as well as their right to judge the law as well as the facts, then we're all in a much, much better place. That's very, very important. And I absolutely agree with you. We have to fight this through the legal system as much as we can, and we need to make sure, though, that the legal system is going to work, and I think we need to do a lot of work on fully informed juries.
Well, I would agree with you, and I'd also point out that the tactics employed by the federal agencies involved have not really changed. They haven't really learned anything from what happened.
Yes. And that's why your documentary is so relevant today. And we even see many of the same actors now and still in positions of authority, but in positions of much higher authority, Eric Holder being one example. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and thank you for your research and your work on this. This is a very, very historically important piece of work. People are going to be talking about this for a very long time and analyzing what went wrong in America. Your documentary series is going to be a seminal piece in that. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Well, it's very, very important that you, this is the documentary, you can get it on our site, and it's very important that you educate yourself and that you educate other people. As Mr. McNulty said, the way our government operates is not any different than the way it worked 20 years ago. And it's one of the reasons why we were so quick to point out that things didn't look quite so right with this marathon bombing here. We have to understand how the government is operating, and we have to educate the public or they will get away with it time and time again. And if they can get away with this kind of conduct that borders between incompetence and malevolence, we have to stop that. And at some point, we can only do that through education. And so the way that you can help with that, educate yourself first, look at the detailed research that Mr. McNulty has done in this series of films and these Freedom of Information requests. It's a very detailed picture as well as a large overview picture. And you can find that at InfoWarsShop.com. You can get a copy there and pass that around. Well, that's it for tonight. Tune in on Monday for the InfoWars Nightly News at 7 Central.